Hello, Robert Carlyle describes the 9/10ths of a character's action beneath the words and calls for a radical fairer deal for British cinema. Then there's the smuggler brother versus cop brother in Diwa, the Indian family drama from the 70s that defined the superstar persona of Amitabh Bachchan. And I'll be talking to the woman who created the most successful British film at the UK box office, the highest grossing musical in the world. Meryl Streep in Mamma Mia, and in a sense the real winner is Judy Kramer, producer, originator, the woman who thought the whole confection up in the first place. I'll be talking to her later. First, though, a film that appears to be a slice of Northern realism that tackles memory, character and politics in a subtle but moving way. Summer is the story of old friends in a former mining town in the East Midlands. Earlier this month it won the Best Director and Feature Awards at the Scottish BAFTAs. Sean, played by Robert Carlyle, lives with his friend Daz, who's a chronic alcoholic confined to a wheelchair. The film explores how they got to this position and how their past infuses the present. Here, Sean meets his first love for the first time in decades.
I did try and find you, you know. Once I got out, they said you were away.
Yeah, in university.
I know.
So how bad is Daz?
Not so good.
Oh, well, that tells me everything.
Oh, he's got a liver problem, you know, milk, loads of other stuff.
Is that because of the accident?
That and the drink.
But it's treatable?
Not really. Not anymore.
Robert Carlyle and Rachel Blake in Summer, directed by Kenny Glenan. Carlyle, an actor whose CV runs the spectrum from two films for Ken Loach to psychotic Bond villain in The World Is Not Enough, previously worked with Glenarm when they were both actors in a film back in 1990. Glenarm's directing debut in 2004, Yasmin, won a number of international awards. When they came into the studio, Kenny Glenarm explained that with its elements of both emotional and social loss, Summer was a mixture of political and personal.
You know, there's more dysfunctionality in this story than there is in Hamlet. But the question you have to ask is, what is rotten in this particular state of Denmark? And the film is, there's no ist or ism attached to it. It doesn't seek to blame anyone. It's not a victim story. It's not saying, oh my God, isn't Margaret Thatcher terrible and blah, blah. It's not interested in that. It's interested in the emotion, the inner life of the two main characters, or the three main characters, and why, and the choices they've made, and how that those choices have been made for them.
And you have this quite complicated structure. I mean, it's deceptively simple when you look at it, but you have two narratives going on, and there's a lot happening in both of those narratives. So, I mean, that keeping that balance as a director, Kenny, must be quite hard.
The film's like an emotional Rubik's Cube, in a way. There's three time scales in the film, and you see three main characters at three different ages. So there's nine actors playing it, which is, on one level, is like a car crash. And part of the success, I think, of the film was to try and bring that into one emotional whole. And the character of Sean is the kind of the centre, the dead centre of this film.
Robert, your character, the middle-aged Sean, he does start to...
I'm
sorry.
No, you're absolutely bang on. So no, I'm laughing.
We're all middle-aged.
Yeah.
But he starts to rediscover that teenage ability to find the line, to find the answer back, doesn't he, towards the end of the film?
He does. I think, you know, you join him at first, he's kind of emotionally crippled, isn't he? And he's coming from that kind of Derbyshire kind of world of maybe no... letting your guard slip too much and maybe not giving too much away. How do you actually explain to someone you're hurting when you can't speak? And I thought that was a beautiful thing about the film. I love playing that. I love, because there's no words. Sean doesn't have words to tell you, but it's there.
It's like if you can imagine an iceberg, and the bit of the iceberg above the water is the dialogue, and the two-thirds of the iceberg that's underneath the surface, the bit that sank the Titanic, that's the bit that we're making the film of. Yeah. That's the bit that you want to film in some way. That's where the heart of it lies. So it's fairly elusive. But men, at the best of the times, compartmentalise their emotions, don't they? And don't tell you what they're thinking. And then it all comes out in a big mad mess every now and again.
So how do you show those things? I mean, you physically, in terms of gestures, its look.
I guess it is. I mean, so much of so much of acting is reacting anyway, you know, and you should never be frightened of that as an actor, you know. The place, I always think, where the drama lives is actually between the lines. It's between the words. A lot of the time, the lines, as in life, a lot of the stuff you're saying is bogus, you know, it doesn't really mean anything. But it's what you're thinking is everything. So it's trying to kind of invest these silences with something. It's trying to show that this guy is somewhere else, or thinking about something else, or is feeling something. And that's the great part of the craft of being an actor, if you can manage to dig that out with zero words.
But are you necessarily thinking what your character's thinking?
Always. See, that's an interesting question, because a lot of the time, you know, especially when you're younger as an actor, you sort of think, oh, you have to go, you know, back catalogue of disasters and take that out and go, right, dust that one down and I'll emote that. But the older you get, and maybe the more experience you get in your craft, the thing is not to do that at all. Is to go directly into the character's pain, the character's emotions, what the character would be feeling.
Now, the way you've shot the landscape is really unusual and bewitching. There's been a tendency to show British landscape in quite a sort of utilitarian, bleak way, but that's not what you're doing here, is it?
No, I don't think so. You know, one of the interesting things I found when I arrived in that area is when you drive down the M1, you look out at these lovely D.H. Lawrence rolling hills and you think, my God, this is beautiful. And of course, you go inland 2 miles and you realise it's not a hill, it's a slag heap that's just started to grow over with grass. Mm. So the whole idea of the past being buried, being underneath, is an interesting notion for Sean, you know. Tarkovsky talks about the present being like grains of sand that just go through your fingers, like bing, 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 and the past acquiring a weight and a resonance because of how much there is and how it just sits there. So you are the sum of your past, you know? Mm. Every time I say that, people smile because they go, I know. So that's what we were digging into.
And then there's also that imagery of sliding down hills or going down the drive in the estate, you know, all the time, the sliding down, which God knows where that's going to take
Kenny
you.
Kenny said a really nice thing at the time when we were shooting, and he said it's not a political film, but you can't escape it. The politics are in the landscape, they're right there. I thought that was lovely.
Now, here's the thing, you're filming in sort of the old Nottinghamshire mining area, but, you know, you've got your lead character, Scottish, you are indeed. So why was this film not made in Scotland?
It's very difficult to talk about things like, you know, tax incentives and stuff like that, especially in the past 24 hours. But it's difficult to talk about that at the best of times, especially when times are hard. You don't want to hear people whinging on about the film industry and how difficult it is. This would be an example. I always give this story as an example of how ridiculous things can be. A few years ago, I did a piece for the BBC called Gunpowder, Treason and Plot. Played James I. Now, that was all shot, every single frame of that was shot in Romania. Now, why? All these places that they talk about in that script are all here. Now, some of them are a wee bit listed in here, and that's fine, but most of them are there. We could have been there. Now, my point about this is, that's BBC licence payers' money. So you're taking it out of the country, never for it to return. Now, it might not be a big, massive pool of money, but you're going to get 50 people, 50 hotel rooms, restaurants, you know, clubs, shops. That little bit of money is all going to be spent in this one area, never to come back. And I see that time and time and time again, because in these countries, no matter, you know how anybody's travelled in these areas, know how poor they are there, they give filmmakers and film companies incentives to come and film there. Why can't we do that here?
Yeah, because you've even got your own production company as well, haven't you?
Allegedly, yeah. It seems to be out
there. It's not producing anything.
It's not producing anything. Which is the key thing you need for a production. No, I do have a company with Antonia Bird, who I've made a few movies with, and Mark Cousins, broadcaster, and Irvin Welsh. And we actually, yeah, this is a classic example. We've got a script at the moment. We have had the script for the past 5 years called The Meat Trade. And The Meat Trade is an Irvin Welsh screenplay. Colin Firth is attached to do it. I'm going to be doing it. Samantha Morton, in fact, has said that she wants to do it. Antonia's going to direct it. Irvine's script. What's the problem? I don't know what the problem is. But successively, we've come up against a brick wall. And it's part of the whole general thing. I think it's very difficult for people to find anything even marginally cerebral in a cinema nowadays. It is almost wall-to-wall American product. Some of that product's good. Some of that product is not so good. I would like to see, especially these big, massive cinemas, you know, these UCGs, whatever they are, I'd like to see one screen set aside for British cinema. How revolutionary is that? What we try to say, we're saying that we don't want British people, don't want to see British film. I don't believe that for a second. I mean, I've been very fortunate to be involved in stuff that not just British people throughout the world want to see. Because when we do it well, we punch well above our weight. We can do it with great technicians, great directors, great actors. It's all there. But we just don't have the platform sometimes to show.
Robert Kalal and Kenny Glenarn. And Summer, which despite its forbidding subject is an illuminating film, is in cinemas next Friday, Certificate 15. On DVD this week, Out of This World Animation in Wall-E, acclaimed French family drama Summer Hours with Juliette Binoche, and Mamma Mia, the fastest-selling DVD of all time in the UK. Well, the producer of the film and stage show, the woman who set the whole machinery in motion, is Judy Kramer, and she's here now. So, Judy, amazing headline figures. I mean, it sold a record amount, this DVD, on its first day, something like 1.7 million copies, is that right?
Yes, I think by this afternoon we're up to about 2.5 million.
And there it is, highest grossing UK film of all time. I mean, it just goes gone building and building.
Yeah, one never takes it for granted, but Mamma Mia's been good at breaking records. I don't really know what it is, but it's fantastic. When we released the film in the middle of the summer, we were up against Batman and all the big serious boys films, and Mamma Mia's kind of got the stamina. It's still in cinemas now and the DVD's released, so it's fantastic.
But I guess you had a clue that there was something to it, insofar as, you know, way back when you thought about the whole idea. Is it true that you actually had a film in mind rather than a stage show?
Yes, way back, nearly 20 years ago now, I was working in film and television, so that was the medium I was in, and I just knew there was a story to tell from these ABBA songs, and Winner Takes It All that Meryl Streep sings in the movie was my inspiration. It's such a great love song, roller coaster, emotional pop ballad. So that's where it all started. But then, you know, I worked in theatre too, so to make it into a musical was the journey it then went on.
And obviously it was a very successful, you know, musical around the world for many years. And then Tom Hanks became interested, I think, in the film rights. But you drove quite a hard bargain in terms of getting what you wanted, because you held out for the writer and director you wanted, despite the fact they had less film experience than a number of others.
Yes, Hollywood showed interest from early on when the show opened in 1999, because, you know, Hollywood's very shrewd, and when they see something's going to work. But we had no intention of making it into a film then. All the studios were interested, including Tom Hanks's company, Playtone, but we were never going to sell the rights. And when the time came to make the film, I very much wanted Phyllida Lloyd to direct it, who had directed the stage show, and Katherine Johnson to write the screenplay. And I felt that those ingredients, that keep the three women who had kind of been the architects of the show, was imperative.
And I spoke to Meryl Streep, who obviously is the central character in Mamma Mia, earlier this year, and she told me about the letter that she wrote to you in 2001.
Well, I said, thank you for the music. You know, basically I said, I had seen it with my daughter. Mamma Mia opened in New York almost right after 9/11. We were living in the city. It had been a very traumatic time. Friends had lost their home, and so their family moved in. There were 10 of us all living in our apartment. A lot of parents at the school where my daughter, who's 10, was attending, had died in the attacks. And the kids were very, they were low. And I thought, oh gosh, what am I going to do for this birthday, you know? I saw the ad in the paper, and it said, new British musical, buoyant fun. And so I thought, well, we're going to definitely try this. Took all the 10-year-olds, and They sat down very quietly in the front and watched the first half, which has a lot of talking in it. And then by the time Dancing Queen came, they just never, ever sat down. And we all walked out of the theater just elated. And I thought, my God, what power this has, you know, to do something good in the world, and thank God for it, and thank Benny and Bjorn for the music and this cast. I had no idea that they Xeroxed my note that I sent to the New York cast and sent it to Phyllida and Judy in England, and they put it on their fridges. You know, 7 years later, they'd come to me. I mean, I wasn't looking for a job or anything.
So was it really on your fridge, that note?
I think it just shows it's always good to write letters. yes, it's certainly in my letter tray, and it has been all those years. It's a handwritten note with Meryl Streep at the top. She had actually said, you know, she just wanted to go up on the stage after the show had finished just to feel what it was like to be on the Mamma Mia stage. But I don't think she did, because she thought it might embarrass her children.
So she saved all that.
So she stayed to wait. She waited till she was in dungarees and singing Dancing Queen.
And was there any pressure to cast anybody else? Because she's not an obvious choice for it. Okay, you know, we now know with hindsight that that was a fantastic choice. But
It's not an obvious choice to other people, but to Phyllida and myself, it was, because we know that the fun of Mamma Mia is real women. I mean, it has to be cast with women that have a bit of kind of history and life to them. And of course, you're always persuaded. I mean, Hollywood would love kind of 35-year-old actresses to play certain roles, but we wanted to go the other way. So we were pushing for slightly older than middle age.
Now, do you think that you might have hit on something? The fact that, you know, there is obviously an audience of slightly older women who do not feel that they have been really very well represented on screen. Do you think you may have hit on something that actually all those Hollywood moguls have missed?
I'm sure we have, but it's quite difficult to do. I think Mamma Mia has an ingredient. We call it the Mamma Mia factor, which defines a kind of spirit, a mood, a kind of zeitgeist, really. And it is, you know, the casting has always been incredible. The same with the show, the casting of those three women and the chemistry. And it is the chemistry of those friendships that is so important, and that it's not kind of putting men down. It's just uplifting in every way.
So it's that chemistry is more important than the formula of, I mean, you've actually got to get that right.
Yes, because I think it does, it appeals to teenage girls, it appeals to, you know, octogenarians, but it also appeals to men in a huge way. I mean, everyone can see themselves up there. That's the big appeal.
And has there been any sense that, you know, some of the big bosses in Hollywood have actually, that it's given them pause for thought?
Oh, I think so. I think, you know, there's definite pause for thought, and I think they think it's fantastic, and it's great that Meryl's leading the way, and she's like rock chick supremo, really. she told me, she sent me an email saying that she, you know, has a whole new fan base now of kind of young teenage girls that kind of wait for her with their autograph books.
And was there a strategy, in the sense that the film keeps getting new legs, as it were, because you had the sing-along version after the straightforward version at the beginning? Was that always planned, or have you sort of altered things as you've seen how successful it's been?
The sing-along wasn't planned. That was a complete, you know, let's see if it was a great way of extending the life, really. But I think Mamma Mia has always been a kind of shared experience. People love, you know, it's a new thing for a movie, because usually the cinema audience leaves just as the credits come up on the screen and run to get the bus. And we wanted to try something else, and it's worked. And the audience love the moment, as they do with the stage show, where they can kind of stand up and join in and dance around to their favourite ABBA songs, and therefore they come back again. It definitely seems to have been a kind of communal theatre, I mean, cinema experience.
Well, our Bollywood expert Anil Sennan is also in the studio, and I just wondered, Anil, do you see any connection when you look at Mamma Mia between that and Bollywood musicals?
Oh, I think Mamma Mia is certainly a proper Bollywood film. I saw it again recently for the second time, and I saw so many Bollywood flourishes. So, for example, Bollywood is famous for wet sari song sequences. Guess what? In Mamma Mia, the pavement just bursts into water and they sing and dance. And when Meryl Streep has her big number running up the cliff in the wind and her scarf blows away, that's Bollywood.
Excellent. Would you agree? I mean, Judy,
No, definitely there's, and I know Phillida loves Bollywood films as I do, and definitely the moment also Dancing Queen, where all the women are skipping down to the jetty, kind of euphoric with happiness.
Judy, thanks very much for the time being. Well, Annie, we've asked you to recommend a DVD for us to rent or buy, so what is it?
Well, it's a film called Diwar, which translates as The Wall. The wall of the title actually refers to the sort of social and emotional divide between two brothers. It's essentially an emotional drama about two brothers on the wrong sides of the law. One is an honest cop, the other is a smuggler. It's set in 1970s Bombay. It wasn't called Mumbai as yet. And their mother has to choose whether she lives with the good son or the smuggler. Obviously, she chooses the good son, even though her favourite, as she says at one point in the film, is actually the bad son.
Now, it's hardly Ingmar Bergman in its depiction of character. However, I believe that at the time it was thought to be quite complex psychologically.
Oh, yes. There are some cartoon characters, in my opinion, especially the villains who are dressed in loud Western jackets. But it struck a sort of emotional bond with Indian audiences. If you think of it, this is 1975. Indira Gandhi was then the prime minister, and she was becoming increasingly despotic and even declared a state of emergency. In this film, the angry young man Vijay, played by Amitabh Bachchan, Bollywood's biggest ever superstar, he single-handedly decides, you know what, I am going to fight an unjust and corrupt system. And he did. And audiences warmed to this. They had never seen something like this on screen. The film was further groundbreaking by having just three songs, which in my opinion were totally unnecessary. So if you see it on DVD, just skip the songs. There is little scope for romance. One of the heroines actually is not a good virgin. They actually show premarital sex, shockingly, for the first time explicitly in a Bollywood film. She gets pregnant, and then there is redemption via that. There's no happy family reunion.
And did it set the persona that Amitabh Bachchan was going to draw, this kind of angry young man thing?
Oh yes, this continued all through the 70s and early 80s, purely because Bollywood or Hindi cinema does not have a tradition for sequels. So he would repeat this character, Vijay, in almost every other film to huge success.
And he wears a cobalt blue shirt very fetchingly throughout.
Yes, with his good luck charm, the 786 symbol, which is considered good luck in Islam.
And so the director is also very well known, is that right?
Yes, it's Yash Chopra, who I would say is the granddad of Bollywood cinema. So he has been making films since the 60s, and he always addresses a sort of serious theme. So this one is corruption, but he's also known for his fluffy romances, set usually in Switzerland.
Anil, thank you very much indeed, and Judy Kramer. Also, Diwar is available on DVD, Certificate PG, and Mamma Mia, if you don't know it by now, is also available, Certificate PG. Well, one of Judy's earliest jobs in the film industry was as assistant to director Michael Radford on White Mischief. Radford later made Il Postino, which on its release was the most successful foreign language film of all time. More recently, he's directed The Merchant of Venice. Flawless, his new film, released this week, is a crime caper movie set in the early 60s, starring Demi Moore and Michael Caine. The film programme asked Michael Radford to recommend a DVD for listeners to rent or buy. He chose Pasolini's Gospel According to St. Matthew, and he explained his reasons.
I admire its poetry, and I admire its simplicity. You know, it's very easy to stun an audience with sound and fury signifying very little. In this, where by very, very simple means, hardly any dialogue, just the selection of faces, he gets you right into the core of the human spirit. When the Spanish student who plays Jesus, this guy with this extraordinary face, starts speaking, all he does really is speak with an intensity. He gives us the Sermon on the Mount, for instance, with an intensity that makes you want to believe all this stuff. It makes you feel good about the world. It makes you feel there's something else out there than everything that we live on our day-to-day basis. And that's magic. I'm not a religious person, but when I see this film, I want to be. You know, he was a Marxist, Pasolini. He didn't believe in God. And it's the most profoundly religious film that you'll ever see. It's hard to say which bit of the film I most admire, but I think that, in a way, what I pick out is his brilliant, brilliant selection of faces to express things. And if I were to pick out a scene of that to begin with, it's the opening scene when you see Mary for the first time. This simple girl who is utterly sure that she's been touched by God. And when you see her face, and there's the whole of the first scene literally is her face and the face of her husband who doubts her, you just are sucked right into absolutely everything that this film is about. There are moments where the soundtrack, which is beautiful, where he uses this fabulous religious music, which once again adds to it. And so he has things like Motherless Child, he has Negro spirituals, he has Missa Solemnis from South America and from Africa. For me, it's the perfect movie. That's why I wish I'd made it.
Michael Radford and The Gospel According to St Matthew is on DVD Certificate U. And you can read more recommendations from, among others, Sir Ridley Scott, Simon Pegg and Stephen Frears at our webpage on bbc.co.uk/radio4. Then you follow the links to the film programme. On next week's programme, the actor Sam Neill, who plays a dog reincarnated in one of the year's film curiosities, Dean Spanley, and novelist Jonathan Coe and Matthew Sweet will discuss a couple of buried treasures from British cinema of the 1970s.
The film programme was presented by Francine Stock and produced by Fiona Cooper.